Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a man who has already been called the 21st century Frost Nixon. It's Richard Herring! You're much better than last week's audience, apart from you. Welcome to another episode of Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. But I was playing Magna Doodle down the Magna Doodle. Remember Magna Doodle? I mentioned it last week. You should have been listening. The kids playing Magna. It's like Etch-a-Sketch, but it never caught on. You can trace comic strips with it. Some children playing that, called it Hellestimus. I don't know if that's going to catch off. So let's see. We've got a quite intellectual audience here today. So I want to... Look, there's a man here with drinking a Stella Artois. That's very posh. What's your name, sir? It's what?
Jason.
And what do you do for a living, Jason? You're a banker. That's nice. It's a good job. No, it's a good job. It's all right. I'm not going to joke about that. How's it going? The banks down there. People don't like you, mate. Drinking Stella. Like, you come down here, you lost all our money, and you're drinking Stella Artois. How dare you? How dare you? Are you with Jason?
Yes.
Yeah. Are you also a banker? You're both very casual. What do you do? What's your name?
Paul.
And what do you do for a living, Paul?
You
sell IT, that's what we want. It's back old, it's old school. No, you come fly by night, newbies. He's a guy who's been doing IT, so we all like Richard's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Let's do a coach trip down. So how's it going, the old IT, information technology, am I right? Yeah. Yeah. On the same level. And you look nervous, what's your name? What's your name?
Henry,
that's a nice name. I've got a vacuum cleaner like that. You got a motorcycle clothing shop badge. Thank you, mate. You're a good lad. I'm not having a go at you. What do you do for a living? You're a graphic designer. Yeah, that's like you're sort of just IT with pencils, isn't it? IT without a computer. Well, you're almost welcome. You're almost welcome, except for you, Jason. You are not welcome. You're not welcome. You're not
welcome. And I'm going to make you leave. Either pay back the money or leave. That's the pay back all of the money or leave. No, you can stay. it's all right. Well, my guest this week is probably best known as the assistant producer of The Saint and the Hanged Man. That's why we all came along today. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Greg Jenner! Here he is. Come in, welcome. Please sit down. How are you, Greg?
No one knows who I am.
Some people do know who you are.
Emergency booking.
It wasn't. I've always wanted to book you. We don't really know each other, but we talked a lot on Twitter. Yeah. And we once bumped into each other in the street. Apart from that, we don't really know each other.
On the basis of great relationships, you know, that's how you... That's
but that's the modern world, isn't it? That you know, I kind of bumped into you and thought, well, I know you. And I thought, I've never met you before in our lives, have we? I don't think.
Yeah. It's weird. Yeah. I mean, it's weird because I know you because I've listened to the show for about 2.5 years. So yeah. This is really surreal. Yeah. I should be there.
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening.
It is like, you may have a terminal illness and your family have paid for you to come along. Really loves. Will you just have him? Yeah, just have him along. We'll just do a 5-minute interview.
You'd think they'd put me on a better podcast, I suppose.
No, he loves it so much. You can go on the Ricky Gervais song. No, Mummy, can I go on Richard Harris? It's all I want to do before I die. What was The Saint and the Hanged Man all about? That sounds good. That's what you're best known for.
Everyone knows The Saint and the Hanged Man. You've been on IMDb, haven't you?
I have, where I go. And there isn't, like, all your things are actually famous, so there isn't much to choose. And that was the only one that I saw that I hadn't heard of.
It's a weird thing. It was a documentary I made about 10 years ago for BBC4, so yeah. I'm immediately showing my nerdy credentials, about the canonisation process of medieval saints in Wales in the 13th century.
Tell me more.
Needless to say, the ratings were huge. It's actually really good fun. It's really interesting. Rob Brydon narrated it.
Wow.
And we sort of decided we would make a really weird, fun, quirky history documentary, because when you're making something that weird, that esoteric, you've got to sort of try and jolly it up a little bit. So we had sort of Monty Python-style animations and graphics. Cool. And we... restaged The Hanging of a Man.
Wow.
It's all about, basically, there's a man called Thomas de Cantelupe, who was a bishop. Thomas de Cantelupe.
Did he invent the cantaloupe?
Yeah, he went through various fruits, and then he was like, I've got it, I've cracked it. He was a very important bishop in Hereford.
You're making this up.
I'm not making this up, it's real. He died, as you do, and then people started coming back to life. When they invoked his name. And so, in the medieval church, in order to investigate if a saint was a saint or not...
Hold on. People came back to life when they invoked his name.
Yeah.
So they were dead. And they went, Thomas de Cantelupe. And then they came back alive. I would say they were alive before they said Thomas de Cantelupe. Someone else said Thomas de Cantelupe and they went, this is nonsense.
Okay.
You've come on. All the historians have got together. Go, let's try and trick Richard Harris. We'll put something that he can't resist in IMDb. Then you come back with this story about Ian Mellon. Come in. Oh, no, Karen, it's very interesting.
No, it's in the medieval world, if someone you loved died, you would say a prayer to the bishop or the saint who had Lazarine powers. And Lazarine powers is the ability to bring someone back from the dead. And that is the absolute A-grade power for a saint. Most saints can't do it.
To be fair, they're not Lazarine powers, they're Jesus' powers. Lazarus was dead and he did when Jesus... Don't call it Lazarine powers.
Fair point.
Lazarus didn't have any powers. Lazarus was dead and Jesus came and... Like, that's going... That's not fair on Jesus, is it?
Maybe Lazarus was the magician and he was the one with the power all along.
Wow.
Jesus was a plant.
Could be, all right.
Anyway, I'm not saying that. But
he was a melon.
He was an eggplant.
Okay.
And then you've got, basically, a woman would say a prayer to Thomas de Cantelupe, and you would measure out the corpse, and you'd say a prayer at a candle to the same height, and then you'd say a prayer to the bishop, and if you were lucky, that man would come back to life.
Lucky.
And a man called William Crack, who was a Welsh criminal, burned down a castle, was hanged at the gallows, and then this lady called Lady de Brioz, who is the wife of the local lord, she did a prayer, and William Crack came back to life.
William Crack.
William Crag. Yeah, it means William the Scabby. Okay. He had sort of scabs all over his face. So he came back to life, and this happened.
This is like interviewing Tony Law again. This sometimes this is.
Yeah.
It sounds amazing.
So
did the show go on as long as this anecdote?
About the same length. I think. About the same length. So it's about the process by which the Catholic Church would investigate whether a saint was a saint or not.
Yeah.
So it was actually about the legal process, about how do you make a saint.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question. I've always wondered, because it's not really up to us to say, is it?
No.
So if someone's canonised on earth and God knows that they're bad, God must go, got to have him up here now, is Halo, because of you
it's
lot.
True, yeah.
Surely God decides who gets to be saints.
No.
No.
No, afraid not.
Okay.
He gets to ratify them, I guess.
Yeah.
But no, it's beatified first, then canonised. So there we go. And you still, the weird thing is that more saints were made in the 20th century than in all of medieval history put together.
Mm.
So it's actually a process that's got easier.
See, I'm going to see if I can get in.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah.
You need three miracles.
Okay. Well, my career's still going, that's one. Just about.
That probably counts as two miracles.
Lazarine powers I've got. So, horrible histories is what people would probably know you best from. Yeah. And you were sort of working behind the scenes on that mainly, though you did appear on occasion.
Yeah, I mean, I'm William the Conqueror's dancing squire.
Yes.
An important role. But yeah, I'm the historian on the show.
Yeah, so you were the advisor to make... Because Horrible Histories is a really brilliant show. I mean, it's a kids' show. But it properly worked for adults as well in the way that kids shows used to, I think, and then didn't for a long time.
Yeah,
Python started off doing, a lot of the Python guys started off doing a history show, didn't they? They did the History of Britain or something. They did a show, Palin and Jones did.
They did after, didn't they? I think maybe they did Ripping Yarns and stuff.
But... They did Ripping Yarns, but I think before in the 60s, really? they did a sort of history sketch show. And there's a sort of Python-esque feel to Horrible Histories, but it's not patronising to kids. Or adults at all. I mean, it's like, both in terms of what you're covering in the history and what you're parodying are very sophisticated in that show.
Yeah, I mean, the point of the show is to obviously make kids laugh.
Yeah.
And that's the job that we sort of take really seriously. But obviously my job is to be sort of the nerd going, well, technically speaking...
But you'd always make sure everything was actually historically accurate.
Yeah,
the costumes were right,
yep.
and all the history was correct.
Yeah,
You could play around and have fun with the
yeah, pantomime. Yeah, it's basically the historically accurate pantomime.
Yeah.
So it's ludicrous from start to finish, because you're doing hip-hop parodies and you know, you're having Henry II on Bake Off. It doesn't make any sense. But all the facts that are in the show have to be double-sourced.
Right.
And I have a 100% veto, so I can cancel any sketch.
Right.
So I get to kind of go, no, make it better, do it again, you know, change it, which obviously I don't do because that's a very expensive thing to do. But the brilliant thing was from day one, I was able to be someone who was working with the team creatively and also had this sort of strange power to say, no, you can't do that.
But you had kind of quite, I mean, I think a lot of people would attempt to, oh, well, let's just, you know, let's do William the Conqueror and let's do Shakespeare and let's not worry too much about, you know, what's going on. But you had quite strict rules about what was allowed within the sketches. So I think, like, anyone, the characters couldn't know about anything from outside of their own period. Is that right?
Yeah. They've got to have the internal logic of the era they're from.
Right.
So you can't have William the Conqueror knowing who David Beckham is. So you can have him on a modern TV show. He can go on Bake Off, but he has to be perplexed by sort of modern references. Which is funny in itself.
Yeah.
You know? And then so the basically what you're trying to do is communicate to kids that the past is obviously this enormous canvas of thousands and thousands of different names and faces and stuff, but that each of these people were occupying a very specific time and place, and they wouldn't know the names of people who came after them.
No.
Even if we know who those people would be.
Sure.
So William the Conqueror would not know who Henry II was.
Right.
Or Beckham or Mel and Sue. So, but that's part of the fun.
Yeah. And it was, the cast was, you know, I think they were fairly new when the early series, only the first five or six series, those guys.
They did five series.
Five series.
Cast, yeah.
And they've got, I mean, they sort of almost are the Monty Python of that generation, aren't they? In terms of the Matthew Bateman and, I mean, all these guys, I can't name them all, but there's Jim Howick and they've all gone on to to be in Peep Show and all sorts of...
Yeah, and also they went on and did Yonderland, which is a brilliantly funny show on Sky, which is, again, a sort of fantasy, historical, sort of mad, wacky wigs and costumes. Yeah, they were... The amazing thing was they didn't know each other.
Right.
So it was just an audition process in 2008. It's been going for 9 years, and we brought some actors in, and the best ones, we went, yeah, he's really funny, she's really funny.
Yeah.
And then we put them in a room for a week, and they just immediately had this chemistry that was extraordinary.
Yeah.
And they're now incredibly close friends. Yeah. And you can't really do that. You can't put people in a room together and go, be funny together.
No.
It just happens. It's just magic.
But also, I think you... Because there aren't many outlets for sketch writers, I think, at the moment. You know, there's a lot. And you had really amazing writers on that show. I'm presuming you didn't pay them anything. Because it's kids TV, and I know how much kids TV pays. But they also, you know, there's a very strong writing on it. There's people from Green Wing and Armstrong and Miller. And
yeah, Steve Punt was series one. I mean, it was my first ever experience of comedy.
Yeah.
And it was terrifying because all of these people I'd grown up watching were just sat around a table. There was about 15 of them all sat at the table, and they would just look at me and go, go on. And I'd have to lecture them about history for 4 hours every Monday, and we'd do this for 14 weeks.
Right.
And so it was just the most terrifying gig of my life.
Yeah.
These professionally funny, brilliant people whose work I knew sort of intimately as a sort of nerdy teenager were now just going, okay, tell me more about William Shakespeare. So yeah, it was an amazing, amazing thing. And everyone in the sort of team had come from adult comedy. So they'd all been working on Green Wing, or they'd been working on Armstrong and Miller, or they'd been working on Partridge.
Yeah.
Everyone kind of came down a little bit from that world and went, okay, well, the money's crap, but this sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Let's all go play. And it's been brilliant fun.
I just like that there's a brilliant song. I mean, there's just so many... There's not like there's the Rosa Parks song, which is amazing and like really, you know, it's brilliant, but it's also incredibly important story to be telling people. Yeah. And then there's the great one with the Kings, where you're just listing all the Kings' names, which is sort of silly, but also
that's
probably
where I'm dancing is William the Conqueror Squire.
Probably going to teach probably a whole generation of kids know the whole genealogy of the British monarchy as a result of that song. So it's an incredible thing to be involved in. But you've I haven't brought it down, have I? What a fool! But your fantastic book we've got another book coming out soon. Is the new book finished or are you working on it?
No, God, no. My editor is here, and I imagine she is
saying, "Where's it coming?"
The finished would be no.
But your first book is it's
finished. Yes.
Yeah, so that is finished. I have a copy, and it's in the dressing room. It's very nice.
Cool, great, well done. Excellent.
And it's the history of the world in a day. So you're basically starting in the morning, and telling everyone the history of toothpaste, and of getting up, and then working the way through the day.
Yeah,
but then throughout all of history.
Yeah, it's called A Million Years in a Day.
Yeah.
And each chapter is a different subject, but all the stuff that you do on a Saturday. So you wake up in bed, it's the history of beds.
Yeah.
You look at the clock, it's the history of time. You brush your teeth, history of dental hygiene. You go to the loo, history of toilets.
Yes.
All the way through the day up to, you know, midnight.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's essentially the history of everything, but sort of tried to be structured around all the stuff that we do all the time.
But lots of, I mean, it must have taken a great deal of research because you're finding out these little nuggets about each subject, but you must have had to read 1,000 books for each chapter.
Yeah, I read 200 books a year every year and have done since 2005.
I read about a quarter of a book a week. And it's the book that I'm talking to about someone on this podcast. And I've read a quarter of your book, and the quarter I've read is very good. So I've read about the history of toilets.
Hey.
I homed in on that one. So
I thought you might.
I may have some questions about toilets. I was surprised toilet paper took a long time to come to the United Kingdom.
Yeah, it took 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Which is slightly delayed.
Yeah.
It was invented in the 9th century in China.
Right.
It arrived in New York in the 1880s.
Right. Why did it take... Why were they keeping it to themselves, the Chinese?
Because China and the West wasn't really communicating.
Right.
And then we went over there and sort of invaded and gave them opium. And they were like, thanks. we'd rather you hadn't. And they kept all their good ideas themselves. We basically took 1,000 years.
What were we using instead of toilet paper?
Well, this is one of my favourite subjects, so I'm glad you've asked.
Good.
The obvious thing is basically rag sleeves, In Islam, you're meant to use pebbles, spoons of pebbles. You're meant to use an odd number of pebbles. So one pebble, three pebbles, five pebbles, seven pebbles. If you're up to nine pebbles, you need to change your diet. Something's gone horribly wrong. Too many curries. In Japan, they use chuki sticks, which were like, you know, when you get like an ice cream and at the end you've got the wooden stick. It's that.
Right. Pretty good.
There's no joke on it, though. It was just sort of, my favourite joke from history is a medieval joke, and it's what's the cleanest leaf in the forest? And the answer is holly, because no one dares wipe his arse on it. And that's indicative of the fact that foliage was kind of commonly used. The Romans used various things. The most famous one was a sponge on a stick,
yes,
called a xylospongion, and that was shared. So they'd have a communal toilet, usually about 12 people in a communal toilet.
Yeah.
Sponge on a stick, do your business, wipe, pass it on.
How many uses would one sponge? Do they wash it out or do they throw it away?
I think they had like some vinegar or some wine that you might give it a dunk.
Okay. Then drink the wine.
but there's a famous story told by Seneca of a German gladiator who didn't want to fight in the arena, and he decided he'd kill himself, and he couldn't find anything to kill himself with, so he ran into the toilet and choked himself to death on the shit sponge. there's a metaphor for really not wanting to fight in the arena.
Well, you say in the book as well, I'd be the same. I find it very difficult in toilets to, like, if it's urinals, I can't go next to another guy. So the idea of like everyone's just sitting in a room together next to, like, we're sitting here. We could be pooing away and having a chat. We could, maybe that's a podcast. Maybe we should give that a go.
Yeah, I mean, the Romans would hang out in toilets.
I wonder if Ed Miliband would come on that one.
It's definitely worth a pilot.
Yeah, I don't think in the modern world that would. I mean, is there anywhere in the modern world that people are? I suppose sometimes girls go to the toilet together, but you don't do stuff, do you? Just chat in there. Is that right? Just chat about me and how much you fancy me, right? When you go,
I mean, modern privacy is obviously acutely different, but I mean, it's a relatively modern thing actually. Privacy is sort of a 19th century invention,
I suppose.
So it's sort of a Victorian invention. Before that, like Louis XIV would just shit in the middle of the room, in the middle of a conversation, he'd just drop his trousers and go. And you just have
that's
to keep
one of the
contact.
Perks of being the king, though, isn't it?
True. We're about 200 years old in terms of the shy weirs.
Yes.
Before that, you just went wherever.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you don't think anyone had shy bladders in the Middle Ages?
I'm sure there were some. I'm absolutely sure there were some. But in terms of society at large, it was much more open.
You have to imagine you're weeing through the other guy's cock. That's how to get over it. So when you're standing next to someone at urinal, you just have to do something that distracts you so much that you're not thinking about what you're thinking about. So if you're imagining, someone told me, and it works, I've done this. You're standing next to someone, imagine you don't look at him when you're doing it.
Right.
And don't hold on to, don't like go, oh, that. Just like, because you're thinking, so you're thinking about him, and then that means you're not thinking about yourself. So you can be anything. You can think of anything that is weird and unsettling.
And when you say weeing through his cock.
Yeah, just imagine, so you've got to imagine that you're always coming out of his penis, and then you can wee, because you're thinking about something so weird.
And when,
imagine you're sucking his penis if that's weird for you. Again, if you would like to suck his penis, that's not a good thing to do.
Not during the wee.
No, because that might... Yeah, well, that's
just
that's a
logistically
good point.
It's hard.
Yeah, it would be. Well, yeah, or
it's
not.
It's just, Or soft, doesn't matter.
I'm going to ask you some general questions. What is the most disgusting thing that has happened in history?
Ever?
Yeah.
I mean, Harvey Weinstein's pretty bad, isn't it? History is everything that's ever happened.
I know, so you're a historian. I want the answer to my question.
Right, how long we got?
Well, it's just one thing.
The thing that's most horrifying, I think, when I tell people... I mean, there are things that are gross and pukey, and you go, ugh, yuck, blah. The thing that's genuinely appalling, I think, is the way that Emperor Nero would turn Christians into candles for his garden parties.
Oh, yes.
And that's genuinely barbaric. He would cover them in oil. Alive and set fire to them and then use them to illuminate his soirees. And that is sort of psychopathic to the extent where you're almost you're almost intrigued to know how he's come up with that. That's so evil that I think...
And how the other guests kind of managed to carry
on.
Yes, lovely wine. Screaming, burning crisps.
Yeah, I mean...
There's some weird smell going on here.
Absolutely.
Not entirely unpleasant, but...
Right, yeah.
It smells like a barbecue, but...
Yeah, I mean, you definitely... You'd probably duck the next party, wouldn't you? You'd probably...
Yeah.
So that's definitely a garden party. So that's pretty grim. But I mean, you know, Vlad the Impaler impaled 40,000 people on spikes and used them as a human fence.
Yeah.
And it was effective. It worked. The idea was to try and... He was scared of being invaded by the Ottoman Empire. He didn't have a big enough army. He thought, how can I scare them? Yeah. I know I'll round up 40,000 people of my own people and I will kebab them and then build a wall out of them. And then basically say, this is what I do to my own people, imagine what I'll do to you.
Yeah, well, it would be off-putting. You'd go somewhere else, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you'd definitely go around that.
Swing by this place.
Exactly.
Try and invade the next town.
It's an early version of the Richard Nixon paranoid style, the idea that if you're insane, people will leave you alone.
Yes.
So it worked.
Do you think that's what Trump's trying to do?
No, I think he's just insane.
Yeah.
Well, actually, not insane. He's just an idiot, but a terrifying idiot.
Yeah.
An idiot who does his diplomacy on Twitter. And... Which is just...
I mean, but the positive thing, and you're still quite a young guy, 30 or 40 years' time, the books are going to be about Trump. It's going to be amazing, isn't it?
It's going to be vast.
Yeah.
It's going to be called, you will not believe what this guy did. Seriously, this happened.
I mean, if there are still books and a world,
yeah,
that's the one downside.
I had a dream last night that Trump nuked Israel by accident. And I was so scared. I woke up... genuinely really sort of shaken by it because it felt so real. And then I remember thinking to myself, but why would he nuke Israel? Israel's an ally. And then I thought, oh, he's Trump. He's an absolute fucking idiot.
But it's
he
the same,
would do that.
Same as Vlad the Impaler. If I've nuked my ally, imagine what I'll do to you.
Yeah.
Imagine how I treat my enemies. People are quite pissed off in America about what I've done.
That's true. I mean, maybe that's it.
Maybe. Well, maybe. I mean, maybe he's just trying to find the thing that makes the Americans finally go, oh, no, mate, come on.
He's trying to find the line.
Come on, just...
He's like a really edgy comedian. He's sort of just doing really, really dark material.
It's incredible. What is the sexiest thing that's ever happened in history?
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the question I get asked all the time. What do you find sexy? And I will try and calibrate for you.
Boobs.
Boobs.
Yeah.
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 On women or men? I mean,
well, mainly women, preferably. But I'm, you know, 50 now, and I can't afford to be choosy.
Okay, I mean, you know, Pope Alexander VI had a lot of orgies.
Yeah,
and they were pretty sexy orgies, pretty exciting orgies.
And that's good because they're Catholics as well, so they're not meant to be doing it. And that adds a little
frisson.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's just like, that's what the Catholic Church is really all about.
Absolutely,
just, you're not meant to do this.
I mean, that's true. But,
I mean, you know, some of it I don't approve of, though. Absolutely. the adult orgies. Some don't know. That's a bit too... Gone a bit far there, mate.
Consent at all times.
Yeah.
And with adults,
yeah,
please.
With adults.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's probably... That's up there with the sexy times.
Yeah, that's quite good.
Although there was incest involved, so maybe we back away from
that. I'm from Somerset. It's all fine.
But I think...
As long as the brothers and sisters were adults,
yeah,
that is...
All right.
I mean, yeah. Did you find there's a lot of pornography about having sex with your family? Have you found that, or is that just what comes into my computer? It just seems like you look at pornography, and it's a lot of it's about having sex with like your stepsisters, usually, or stepbrothers. It seems so weird. I kind of want to think about that.
Is that just what you're looking for?
I don't know. I think it's on the general... I just look on the general site.
The general?
I just look at the general,
your standard
porn.
Sainsbury's.
And it just seems to be all having sex with each other's daughters. And...
Well, I suspect...
But it's still it works, but it's just... You have to overcome a little in your brain.
You're right. I'll check it out. I'll look into it.
Just have a look into it. Don't understand that. What is...
I'm not regretting this at all. I mean,
what is... Hold on. Who was the first person to get drunk in all of history?
Well, so, I mean, the first person to get drunk in all of history, we don't know, because we know that people were drinking in the Stone Age, and we don't know their name. But the first person to die from alcohol poisoning was Ristad Mac Ricnail, who was an Irish chieftain in the 1440s.
Yeah.
It's very hard to say that name.
Yeah.
And Ristad Mac Ricnail. And he basically was the first ever person to drink whiskey.
Okay.
So it was called Usquebá, which is the Irish name for whiskey. And up until the 1600s, whiskey was a medicine, wasn't a drink. But he pursued it anyway. And he kept drinking it, and he's the first person. And it was called aquavitae at the time. The Latin was the water of life.
Okay.
It was thought to be a medicine that prolonged your life. He died, and everyone went, oh, well, there we go. You can die from it. So
let's turn that into
an
industry.
That was about 600 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. What is the drunkest thing that has ever... What's the most stupid thing someone's done drunk in history? Apart from that, not dying. Like someone who's been in charge of something but has been drunk. What is the biggest mistake they've made in history, in the whole of history?
There are loads, aren't there? Okay, and there are way too many.
Are there? Name one.
The one that immediately comes to my brain is there was a really famous actor about 200 years ago here in Britain called Edmund Kean, and he was a superstar actor. He was the Kenneth Branagh of his age. He did a brilliant Richard III. Everyone loved him. But he got so drunk, constantly getting drunk, he would miss his own performances. Famously, one night he missed a performance, the understudy went on, and halfway through the show he yelled out, "You're doing really well!" Which I think is lovely. But my favourite thing about him is that he would go missing for an entire week, and they would have to try and find him, and they'd find him in a pub in Deptford or something. But one night he came back, absolutely slaughtered, hammered, drunk, and went to bed with his wife. Woke up in the morning by his wife, said, "Edmund, there's a man on the door. He says he's got a ship for you." And Edmund's like, what are you talking about? And the man came in and said, "Yeah, last night I sold you a yacht." and he was like, "Oh, not a lot of use for a yacht." But he turned to his wife and said, "Do you want to live on the Thames?" She said, "No, quite like the house we're in." He was like, "All right." So he tried to sell the yacht back to the man, and the man was like, "No, it's yours now." And so he had to basically give the man, I think, 70% of what he paid for it,
right,
to take the yacht back.
Wow.
And that's just a nice story that I think is a good reminder that you should probably
not buy a yacht. It's kind of interesting which stories end up remembered, right?
Yeah.
So, like, of all the things that happen, and every now and again, like, even like history from a long time ago, you'll get one little human detail. I remember, like, this, I can't remember which battle it was, but there was a siege of a castle, and some guy was mooning the battlements, and someone shot an arrow into his arse.
Yeah,
you know? and that isn't in the history books, you know. And that guy will be, you know.
Yeah.
Will be remembered for, but he's still remembered, whatever, 800, 900 years later for that incident.
Yeah, it's a form of sort of infamy, isn't it?
Yeah.
You kind of get remembered for that one thing, that one time, guys, which I like that. I like the fact that, and obviously this is what we do on Horrible Histories, we sort of zero in on these moments of human idiocy and go, that's it, that's you'll be famous forever with children for that one stupid decision you made.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are people who made terrible, terrible mistakes and decisions. But there are people who deliberately tried to get in the history books. So there's a guy called Herostratus, who was a villain back in the ancient Greek times, and he really, really wanted to be famous, and he had no skills, and he had no money, and he was a former slave, and he was like, "Oh, what can I do? How can I get famous?" And he was like, "Oh, I'll just burn down the Temple of Ephesus." Classic. One of the seven wonders of the world. That'll do it. Job done. Set fire to it. Everyone was quite upset. They tortured him, interrogated him. They said, "Why did he do it?" He said, "I want to be famous." And the punishment was that he would be akleon, the Greek word meaning struck from the history books. He would have his name removed forever. And that was his punishment because he desperately wanted to be famous.
Yeah.
And they were like, "Right, your punishment is you will never be famous." But his name was Herostratus. Because when people burn down temples, you talk about it. We can't help it.
Yeah.
There's now a syndrome named after him, Herostratus syndrome, and it's unfortunately what mass shooters are.
Okay.
That's what they do when they want to be on the news, and they go and shoot people in churches and in schools.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Herostratus syndrome is this narcissistic personality disorder but where you feel it's okay to murder because you'll get to be famous.
It's worked out brilliantly for him, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Got a whole thing named
exactly.
After him.
So
he must be punching the air every time that happens.
He's loving it. He's loving it. And he appeared in Chaucer's poem, The House of Fame, in the 1380s. So he's done really well for himself.
And yet there are whole civilizations that are forgotten.
Yeah.
You know, and that you might find like some tiny artifact to go, oh, there was an amazing civilization here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we don't know about some of them. Atlantis, that's one of them.
That is not one of them.
That is one. Watch out for that. What I like, this is a bit I liked, I can't remember what you were, I think you might have been talking about toilets at this point in the book.
It's probably.
But you said, and I'm going to use one of your questions you asked in the book as an emergency question.
Okay.
Which is, how old are toilets? So that is my new emergency question. Language is a portal to the past. I like that idea, but that is very true, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the words we use they become synonymous and we use them interchangeably. And that line is about the fact that we can talk about a toilet and we can use things like privy, lav, john, shitter, loo. We've got all these euphemisms for them, but they all come from different places and they used to have different meanings and very specific. Lavatory derives from the French for laver, to wash. Mm-hmm. It used to be a room where you washed in and there was no toilet in it. And until the 18th century, the word toilet meant to clean yourself or to put your makeup on. So you'd still see in the 19th century a guide to a woman's toilet would not be what you're thinking it is. It would certainly not be the sort of creepy stalker. It was basically how to put your makeup on. Right. So words have a sort of different meaning. In terms of the oldest toilet, well, obviously toilets go way, way, way back, but the Harappans in the Bronze Age had toilets. They had very impressive toilets. That was 4,500 years ago. And the toilet seat is about 5,200 years old and was invented in ancient Egypt and was stone, was carved like a toilet seat you'd use now. Mm-hmm. You didn't flip it up and drop it, hinge it, because obviously if it landed on your penis it would be terrifying and painful. So they very much had that as a permanent down. But toilets in that sense go way back to the Bronze Age, and obviously people have been pooing forever.
They have. Who was the first person to ever poo?
Well, that was obviously Gerald the pooer.
Should know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's lots of little things you could pick out of the book. One that fascinated me that I chanced across was I think it was the Romans used Portuguese boys' urine as mouthwash.
Yeah. The idea, I call
but
it...
But specifically Portuguese boys.
Yeah, so I call it pisterine.
Right.
And, sorry, I know. The kids love that one. But we're not sure if this is true or not, but this is one of the things that's sort of recorded, and obviously historical facts are often actually not true at all, but they're written down, and we get to go, well, it's written down, we get to use it in horrible histories. The story was that aristocracy would import Portuguese wee all the way from Portugal, presumably because of the diet, I guess. Maybe right. They sort of ate a specific type of clam or something. Yeah. That,
asparagus.
Maybe asparagus. But the idea was that you would gargle it to clean your teeth, and it worked quite well. And the Inca also would shave their legs with human urine, so we call that shampoo rather than shampoo. So yeah, urine's very useful, and poo's very useful in history as well.
Yeah.
So the Romans would collect wee, they would collect poo. That was an actual job, to be a fella who collected wee for a living.
Yeah, it's not too bad.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way capitalism's going again, isn't it? I mean, now
it's Donald Uber Trump doesn't mind a bit of that, does he? You know what I'm saying? Is that how he made his millions? Well, I'd like to talk to you about the history. Well, I'll ask you this because this is an emergency question that works with you. If you had a finger that could travel through time,
oh yeah, okay,
where would your finger go, and what would you do with it?
I mean, so many eyeballs to poke, aren't there? I mean, the obvious one would be to travel through time and go all the way back to a really important speech and then just dangle the finger out the front of someone's fly so it looks like their penis is hanging out.
Yeah.
Maybe like Churchill.
Yeah.
Just in the middle of the sort of, you know, we will never surrender.
Yeah.
Just a little penis finger hanging out the front.
That would mean Hitler would win the war, though, wouldn't it? If that happened, that would just...
I don't know. I think Hitler would have found it amusing and probably would have called off the bombers. I think he'd be like, this is a man I can get behind. He's got a sense of humour. I'll leave this behind. Yeah, I think definitely... Because that's a classic. Kids love that. Adults love that. I mean, that's definitely...
And if the whole lot of you could travel in time...
Right, yeah.
Which you cannot do. I wanted to just tell you it's not possible. But if it was, just imagine it was possible. Which historical period would you most like to go to, or who would you like to go and investigate?
I would love to go back to probably back to 2005. Have a word with Gordon Brown. Just give him a quick heads up and go. Just so you know, it's not going to end well. I mean, I've always said that I'm an asthmatic with allergies. I would die in any period of history prior to the invention of penicillin in 1945. Yeah. So it would be an idiotic decision to get anywhere before that. But I've always...
What if you could take penicillin with you?
Sure.
A, you could make yourself all right. And B, you could sell penicillin.
Hey.
And take an iPhone or two and a radio mask.
Did you know penicillin is made of a cantaloupe? So we're back to cantaloupe.
Oh, I didn't know.
It was made for... So the vital penicillin that was taken... The first time penicillin was used was in large quantities was at D-Day, 1944. And it was made from a cantaloupe, taken from a mouldy cantaloupe in someone's cupboard.
Right.
And she worked at, I think, Pfizer in the States. And
we have some fans of the American drug companies in there. Yeah, stealing money from the poor. But is it the erection thing that's excited you?
Basically they were trying desperately to find the strain of penicillin that grew naturally in fruit, and they couldn't find a strong enough one. And they had a sort of they sent out a kind of letter saying to all the members of staff, please bring in your mouldy fruit, like a sort of bring and buy sale. And she brought in this cantaloupe, and that was the one, and that's the very basis of all penicillin used now to this day.
I did not know that.
No. So, I don't know what we were talking about before. But
where you would go if you could, all of you could.
Oh, right,
back.
Sorry. I think I'd really like to go and meet Leonardo da Vinci.
Okay.
And just go, hey, like, just, what's going on?
Yeah.
Because he was a brilliant man who never finished anything.
Work a bit harder on the helicopter.
Yes, exactly. You know, the ornicopter, as he called it.
Yes.
He's my favourite person from history because he was brilliant. And also, not a racist.
Okay.
So many people in history racist. As soon as you go back, they're absolute dicks. So yeah. I reckon he'd be all right. I reckon you could invite him to dinner and he wouldn't, like, talk about eugenics. Yeah. So, you know. And you can't say that about people who live now, because there are plenty of people now who do that. Yeah. So Da Vinci all the way.
Yeah, okay.
Or Leonardo, as his
fans of Pfizer and Leonardo da Vinci. We're getting, one by one, we're going to work through this audience so everyone's found a subject that they can get behind.
Yeah, who else do you want? Well, what else can we do?
Do you ever want, I'd like to go back and see what Jesus was all about.
Sure.
But then what if you went back and discovered that you were Jesus? You went back and then you found out...
That I was Jesus.
Both of us could have a crack at it. But you went back and you discovered the person who was Jesus was actually you who'd travelled back in time with your wisdom. But then also you'd have to go, fuck, I've got to remember all the stuff that Jesus said. So it ends up in the New Testament. And then that's why the New Testament's all fucked up. Because you go, I think the wine becomes blood, my blood or not. I can't remember. Don't just keep it vague. I can't remember which one works out.
Do you think...
Blessed are the peacemakers.
Yeah.
And you have to come through all that.
Do you reckon Goodnight Sweetheart would have been as good? If Nicholas Lyndhurst went back and was Jesus.
Yes, I think it would be as good. It would be exactly as good. And it would be exactly as good casting. I'm very interested in the historical figure Rasputin.
You are?
And I've written a best-selling play about it. And a musical about him. I think I've come up with something in the Rasputin story that I don't think any other historian has noticed. I'm interested in seeing if what you think about it. There's all this bullshit about Rasputin. I think Rasputin's a very interesting story in terms of history, okay? Because it's become historical fact that if you read books about Rasputin, most of them will just give this verbatim story that I should know his name because I wrote a play about him, but I'm tired.
Yusupov, is it?
Felix Yusupov.
Yeah.
He just made it, well, him and the co-conspirators said that he kept on coming back alive and they had to shoot him, and none of it really added up, right? And when you look at it, they're obviously hiding something. But Rasputin is found in the river with his hands tied, and he's kind of managed to get his hand out of one of the ropes. But there's no reason why Rasputin should have his hands tied, because according to the story that they're telling, he's been shot and then escaped and then run away and then been shot again. And you wouldn't tie his hands if he was dead, right? To throw him in the river.
Sure.
So doesn't the fact that his hands were tied prove that the story that he was... it's very specifically for me, this bit. So this is the bit I'm going hooray in. Doesn't that prove that... There's another theory that the British Secret Service...
Yes.
..kind of kid got him. They were worried what he was going to do, so they basically tortured him and killed and murdered him, which makes a lot more sense.
Well, the bullet was traced back to a specific type of revolver used by MI6 at the time.
Yes.
So the idea was that basically they'd shot him or they'd give him Yusupov the gun to shoot him.
Yeah. So doesn't that prove that he had his hands tied, that that's the case?
I forgot what the question is. But,
okay. So just say yes, and then and I can put it as proven by an historian.
But your interest in Rasputin interests me, because I don't know why you find him so compelling.
Lots, because I think he's the world's first... You should like it, because you're writing a book about celebrity, he's the world's first... superstar, like he's almost a pop star. I did a sort of joke show about him having written all of Boney M's songs and been the original pop star, but he sort of was, in that he rose up through the ranks from nothing and then became this massive figure that was a celebrity and could do whatever he wanted and didn't get into trouble for all the awful things he was doing, potentially. He treated women very badly or well, whichever way you look at it. But his myth... Well, again... No, but whichever way you look at him as a character, some people think that the women liked him, some people think that he was abusing his power in a Harvey Weinstein kind of way. But, you know, he's was a myth even when he was alive.
Yes.
And he said, when I was starting being interested in him, there were still people alive who would have met him and known him. And yet he was a historical figure that was a myth, and his death story is not true. Mm-hmm. I think all those things are just very fascinating. Plus, I think initially he drank a lot and shagged women, and when I was 14, I thought, that's amazing. So I think that's what drew me in.
Yeah.
And he was sort of magic, and he came back to life, and that drew me in as a teenager.
But so there's Jesus, though.
But I was religious when I was young, and I was fascinated by all that sort of stuff. But then I think, as an historian, I think he's just a very fascinating subject. A, to rise from nothing and be that powerful,
and then
not be powerful again because you're dead, and B, to be a living myth, in that even people who talk about him they all disagree about what his motives were, what he looked like, whether he was clean, whether he was dirty, whether he was brown, blue eyes, or whatever. You know, they all had different versions of him. I think that historically is quite interesting.
Well, I've enjoyed that answer.
Thank you.
But I think you're absolutely right. It's so interesting is that how living people are interpreted and spun, and the stories they put out about themselves and the stories that other people put out about them is really intriguing. And obviously history is written by the victors, but also some people try and write their own history. So Winston Churchill wrote his own history.
Yes.
He was like, I'm going to make sure people remember me as a great man, and they have, and he was a great man, but he absolutely wrote that in that story himself. And it's a really effective way of ensuring that people will remember you fondly. But what's interesting is that the posthumous legacy sometimes goes horribly wrong about 20 years after you die.
Yes.
You can be sort of lauded, and then it's like, ooh, fall off.
Well, I think in Russia, Rasputin's not really even talked about much. I went to St. Petersburg, and there is a Rasputin tour, but it's for tourists. And the actual Russian history, as we had Amanda on the other week, but it's kind of, and it's like hyper history. It's like, you know, it's history squared, isn't it? And everything that the Tsars did and everything that the communists did, it was just so horrific and so...
Yeah, there's no
huge.
Good guys.
No.
There's very few people you can go, well, he was nice. it's, yeah, I mean, even people like Lenin, so, you know, you can... you can kind of go, well, they had interesting ideas, but ultimately these people were brutal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. And obviously this is the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting just at the moment watching people arguing about whether it's a good thing or not, you know. And I think people like Paul Mason sort of going, well, you know, intellectually. And you go, yeah, people died. Yeah. History is an ongoing conversation. It's an ongoing argument. What I find so interesting is how people in their own lifetime get spun. So, you know, Ed Miliband.
Yes.
Is a man who, his reputation, it changes week by week, and who, his reputation was forged by comedians, by the media, and he was desperately struggling to try and put forward his own version of himself, his own persona. And that's what happens all the time in history. And the problem with being a historian is you don't know who you're trusting. You can't necessarily go, oh, well, this is a very valid... You know, Charlemagne, you had all his stories written for him by a guy called Knock at the Stammerer. And people who kind of were writing propaganda for him. So, yeah. You know, how can we trust that Alfred the Great was great? Maybe he was Alfred the Dickhead.
Well, and also, because so, you know, I'm very interested in archaeology, I know you are, and you're always true. It's very worth following on Twitter for lots of reasons, but one reason is that you always post very interesting articles to go and look at, as well as lots of funny jokes. But, you know, if, for example, the millstone was the only thing from the 21st century to be discovered, you would think, my God, who was this? what was this civilization that put these laws? We can't quite translate them. We don't know. It could be the Rosetta Stone of the future somehow. But, you know, if that's the thing that happens to survive, it's got to be buried somewhere, hasn't it? So,
yeah, I mean, about 3 years ago, I tried to pitch a TV program exactly that, which was how would future archaeologists see our society?
Yeah.
And obviously what would survive after the flood would be plastic.
Yes.
So mobile phones would survive. They would, and like Justin Bieber dolls would survive. But like all the records would go. We'd lose most of the sort of cloth and the fabric. So yeah, it would be amazing to see how in 200 years' time our society now is.
And I think like things like, because again, this is another of my obsessions, but like Chaplin and Hitler, there's been lots of busts of Hitler and lots of little dolls of Charlie Chaplin. Mm. And in 5,000 years' time, if you don't know anything else, you would imagine that was the same, wouldn't you? You get two of those. Well, we found these. They're from the same time period. This has got to be two representations of the same god or person or whatever the fuck this is. Sometimes he's got a little cane. Sometimes got this strange symbol on him. Very stern sometimes. Then he's very happy.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? So, when you're trying to, when we're trying to do that to things in the past, you know, how many terrible mistakes are we making?
All the time.
In trying to, you know, because also it's very difficult to not ascribe modern day, which I think your book is really great at really trying to get to the heart of not doing it, that of not imposing what our views are on the people of the past.
Yeah, I mean, my book is deliberately jokey. My joke is very booky. My one joke, the book is deliberately amusing in a sort of sense. For a history book, it's funnier than a history book. Obviously, I'm not a comedian. I'm not as funny as you, Richard Herring.
The book's very, very funny, you know. And a lot of history is very dry, and a lot of historians aren't great writers. Okay, we had Mary Beard on, who I think is a fabulous writer.
Yeah,
and so she makes it all come alive, and she's funny enough, but also it's very erudite and clever. And a lot of historians are dry, and I think the best way to really, you know, it doesn't just work for kids. The best way to educate people is to entertain them, and then they'll remember all the other stuff around it. So if you give them something to hook onto that's entertaining or interesting, then, you know, that will be enough to draw you in and want to find
out.
That
was the hope. The hope was the idea was to write a book that would be for people who'd never read a history book in their life, but it would also work for people who'd read 300 history books.
Yeah.
And it's a really hard Venn diagram, because you've got to write a book that's kind of like working for people who like history, oh fuck that, and people who are like, I love history. So it was tricky to sort of find that middle ground, but I enjoy doing it and people seem to quite like it. And that's
but there's
nice.
Lots of things, you know, there are lots of things that surprise you in that book and facts that come up that you haven't thought about. It's very, do read it. And your next book is about celebrity.
Yeah, it's called Hopefully Dead Famous.
Right.
I've written like 7,000 words. It's so far, like, doesn't really exist. It exists in my head. But it's about the history of celebrity from ancient Greece up until the 1950s.
Right.
Because we think of celebrity as a 20th century thing. You know, it's interesting you said Rasputin was the first pop star. I would quibble with that. Mm-hmm. Because there were pop stars in the 19th century, like Jenny Lind, who was an opera singer, who was enormous, huge. But you're absolutely right that traditionally, that kind of period of history, about 1911, when Hollywood cinema arrives and everyone goes, ta-da!
Yeah.
And that's when sociologists had said that's when celebrity was born, that minute. But it's much older than that. It's really interesting to see how far back it goes. So I'm enjoying tracking it back and rummaging through 17th, 18th century stuff, but also back to the medieval saints, back to Thomas de Cantilupe. People travelled hundreds of miles to go and touch his tomb, but they would also be chained overnight to it.
Right.
So if you had someone with a disability or an injury, or they were mad or whatever, you would chain your person to the tomb overnight in the hope that they would be healed in the morning. Mm. And we get the word tawdry from the shrine of St. Audrey in Ely, I think, because people used to stand outside the front selling tat.
Yeah.
So it's equivalent of standing outside a gig, you know, and getting T-shirts printed up and little badges and things. So there was already a sort of... I'm not saying anything, Richard. I mean, your stuff's not tawdry. It's classy.
It's classy. Look at that guy.
But
no one, everyone's looking at him going, what's classy?
But there was a commercial economy to these personalities 800 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying. And I think, like, the 20th century, you did get suddenly these peasant people becoming rulers of massive countries. You know?
Sure.
Not to say that never happened. And Catherine the Great came from a fairly
was German royalty, but it's.
I mean, but she rose up, and you know, so there are exceptions to that, but rulers were the ruling class, and then suddenly had these. Certainly in Russia, it was a sort of presage of what was to come, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, history is also cyclical as well. So you go back a long way, and actually you find these patterns of recurrence. You know,
if you find the right place in the cycle, do you think you can work out what's going to happen next?
No.
Okay. Not a very good circle, then, is it? You're from Tunbridge Wells.
I'm from Royal Tunbridge Wells.
What is your favourite bit of history that's happened in Royal Tunbridge Wells?
Well, it was that sort of a spa town.
Yes.
Where the celebrities and the royal court would go to drink the waters, because the waters there are disgustingly iron-based. It's like iron brew without the deliciousness. And so it was kind of a weird town where people would come for like 3 months to kind of hang out, and they go to the theatre and stuff. So nothing particularly exciting happened there, but that was sort of, it was the kind of place to be seen. It was like the Hamptons of Kent.
Did you ever hang out down the Pantiles?
Hey, I've been to the Pantiles.
Yeah, cool.
I was dropped on my head on the Pantiles when my dad is a baby. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Explains a lot, I think. The Pantiles are very old flagstones that you don't want to drop your baby on. So
that's what your dad did. It's like a Tunbridge Wells tradition, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Take your newborn baby
down. It's a ceremonial thing. You take your child out, you fling them to the floor, you hope they're alive, you carry on.
Cool. Are there more horrible histories to come?
Sort of.
Yeah.
Right, so we made a full series this year, and the BBC have put some of them on the shelf for next year. So there'll be like an episode dedicated to Florence Nightingale that will come out maybe after Christmas, which is a really good fun. We're making the Horrible Histories movie.
Oh, great.
And that's the exciting thing.
Cool.
But I can't tell you anything about it.
Will there be any history in it?
No.
Okay.
It's going to be set in 2017, and it's weird. Ed Miliband's playing all the roles. It's quite a meta film, in fairness. Lars von Trier is directing. It's really going to push some boundaries. It's going to be set in a Roman Britain. It's going to be the story of Boudicca. So it's fun.
Yeah, I wheedled something. He said he wouldn't tell us anything, and then I look at that. That's proper interviewing. That is. And my producer Ben Walker, who I am indebted to, said that you were trying to make something go. You were investigating getting things to go viral. Is this correct?
Oh yes. God, that makes me sound like I'm sort of some sort of supervillain who's trying to. No, just like 3 years ago, I just wanted to know if it was possible to go viral on Twitter.
Right.
Because I was writing the book, and I got to the bit about Martin Luther and how ideas spread. And we've just this week had the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, which is sort of big history, big serious history. But I was curious to know, how did he get his ideas out? How do you spread an idea? So I was curious to see if I could spread an idea. So I came up with a hashtag, which is #2WordCV. #2WordCV, and you had to describe yourself in 2 words. And I wanted to see if I could get the world to get it to trend on Twitter. And I sort of learned a lot, and I wrote a sort of essay on my website about this, but I realised that I couldn't get it to trend without Al Murray and Catelyn Moran's help. And so it was quite interesting. I had 5,000 Twitter followers at the time. I was like, oh, maybe that's enough. And it wasn't enough.
No.
So it sort of was an eye-opening thing about how celebrity networks are really important in spreading ideas. And It ended up trending globally on Twitter. It ended up number one on around the world on Twitter, but only with their help.
Right. But then that's how it works, though, isn't it? That's how things do go viral, with someone
yeah,
latches onto it.
But it's quite depressing, because it means that sometimes good ideas will never spread.
Oh, God.
And bad ideas can spread.
Tell me
easily.
About it.
So there's a virality of an idea, the mimesis.
But, you know, if an idea is good and exists, that is all that matters. It doesn't matter if you're the only person who knows about it.
That's quite depressing, isn't it? No, I don't want that.
Yeah.
Take that back.
Is it what? You want to ask him the human centipede question? This isn't like a request show. It's not like you're at a gig. Do the human centipede! If you had to be in a human centipede with two characters from history...
Oh.
Yeah? Which is still any human being alive. So this is no different than the regular question. Who, if you're in the middle, who would you put at the front and at the back? I presume you're a Portuguese weeing boy ahead of you. So I don't know if you've got that in his mouth. So it's gone weird. It's all right if it's a Portuguese boy's anus in your mouth, but...
Is it though?
Yeah, it is, but I'm
not sure it is.
No, it is. That's fine. In the human centipede universe, that's okay, but I think human centipede professors or whatever that guy is would go, oh no, you can't put their penises in the mouth. That's wrong. That damages the whole ethos of the human centipede. It's not meant to be like that. It's not about we and.
No, I mean.
But if you had to be. I would choose a Portuguese boy, a weeing boy,
right.
From the Roman times.
Okay. It's good to
when
know.
It was all right to be a paedophile. So I'm not breaking any rules. And also I'm just drinking his wee, and that's also allowed. That's still allowed.
Am I in the middle? I mean, where am
middle,
I?
Yeah,
I'm in the middle.
So you've got a historical figure ahead of you, and then you're going to poo into the mouth of an historical.
So then, the obvious answer then is you want a villain behind you.
Yeah,
who
well,
gets punished.
Yeah,
and you want someone ahead of you who's got a decent diet.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So
or just that you'd like to eat the poo off,
right.
Or that you think you're worse off than to them, you would be a villain and deserve to be.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Who would I be a villain to?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah. Which historical figure would you be a villain to?
Yeah.
That is a good question.
Well. I mean, in terms of who's come out badly on Horrible Histories, who have we vilified on Horrible Histories? We've definitely given William the Conqueror quite a kicking.
Yeah, he was a
bastard. I mean, he was called William the Bastard. He was an actual bastard.
I call him William the Cunt. There must have been someone called that. I mean, Canute probably.
Well, there was actually an Anglo-Saxon man called Edward Clawcunt.
Right.
And it's slightly alarming because it probably means that he was a bit like Donald Trump. He was probably a pussy grabber.
Mm.
So he's probably clawing at... Yeah. Or his face looked like a clawcunt. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's... yeah, he was... that's a name from history that you don't
anyway,
know.
Anyway, William the Conqueror.
William the Conqueror in the front.
In front of you.
Because I think he would want to get vengeance on me, and I'm willing to take that.
Yeah.
So provided
didn't
I get...
When he died, didn't he blow up?
Yeah, he exploded.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was quite obese, and he fell off his horse and smashed his tummy on the pommel of the horse, the saddle bit.
Yeah.
And they then tried to cram him into a stone coffin that was too small, and they were sort of cramming very hard. And his tummy just exploded with gas, and also the church caught fire at the same time.
Because of the explosion?
No, just unrelated. And weirdly, the church also caught fire at his coronation. He's the only man in history who basically was present at arson during the coronation and his funeral. So it didn't end well. So William the Conqueror in the front.
Yeah,
I'll take that for the team.
Okay.
Who am I going to deliver vengeance to? I mean, oh, goodness. I mean, you know, it's going to have to be Hitler, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's going to have to be Hitler, you know.
That'll teach him.
Yeah, I mean.
he's going to rue the day now.
Yeah,
he has
exactly.
to eat Greg Jenner's poo.
He is, you know.
Mixed with William the Conqueror's poo.
Yeah, absolutely. He's going to be getting.
Yeah.
And also, you know, if Hitler was a vegetarian, William the Conqueror ate a lot of meat.
Yeah.
So we're going to do him that way as well.
Yeah. It's a good question. Well done for thinking of that question. So, ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive round of applause to Greg Jenner. Don't think we can beat that. Thank you so much. You have been this listening to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre Podcast with me, Rich Herring, and my guest, Greg Jenner. The music's by Pest. The people I'm indebted to are Leicester Square Theatre, Go Past the Stripe, British Comedy Guide, Ian Tunes, Ewan Tube, all that lot. The producer is Ben Walker. It's a Fuzz, Go Past the Stripe, and Sky Potato production.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.